This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Welcome, everybody, to the National Museum of Australia, the second in our series of platform conversations. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which the museum stands, the Ngunnawal and the Ambri people, and pay my respects to their elders, past and present. Now, this platform conversation this evening with Peter Singer and Jenny Brockie was booked out, we will be giving everybody advance notice of future platform conversations, so please leave your email details if you would like to get in early later in the year when we have our next platform conversation. We don't want people to miss out. There are tonight a select range of Peter's books available at the information hub, and that's a good opportunity to get a signed copy of one of Peter's many books. I'm advising that this event is being photographed and recorded for museum-related web spaces, and that the program may be broadcast on Sky TV's Australian Public Affairs channel at a later date. And also to let you know that by asking a question during the question and answer session at the end of the program, you will be providing your consent to be recorded. It leaves only one thing to remind everybody now, and that is to please switch off your mobile phones. And I would now like to hand over to Jenny Brockie. Would you please make Jenny Brockie welcome to the National Museum? Jenny.
Thank you very much, Andrew, and welcome, everybody. It's great to be here this evening to revisit a rather huge topic, how ethical is Australia, with one of the world's best-known ethicists, Professor Peter Singer. You'll hear from Peter in a moment, but first I just want to run through how the evening is going to work. Peter is going to speak for about 30 minutes. Then I'll have a chat with him briefly. I'll be putting some questions to him that have been raised online in the run-up to this event. And then I'll be taking questions from the floor that you might have for him. So hold those thoughts as you're listening to him speak. And if necessary, make a note for yourself of the thing that you'd like to raise, because there will be time to have questions after Peter has spoken. I should just mention the online poll results related to this topic. The museum on its website did throw out the question, how well is Australia performing as a global citizen? We have a small sample size at this stage, but of the 59 people who've answered that question, and I would encourage you all after tonight to join that poll and have your say about it. But of the people who have answered, these are the way the votes are falling at the moment. 5% of people say that Australia is performing well as a global citizen. 39% of people think we could try harder. 51% of people think our performance is poor. And 5% of people don't know. So that's where the poll's up to, and I would urge you all to log on and have your say on that question. For those of you who don't know, Peter Singer was born in Melbourne and educated at the University of Melbourne and the University of Oxford. Since 1999, he's been Professor of Bioethics in the University Centre for Human Values at Princeton University. He's also Laureate Professor at the University of Melbourne in Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics. Peter burst onto the international scene with the publication of Animal Liberation in 1975. He has written, co-authored, edited or co-edited more than 40 other books, including Practical Ethics, How Are We to Live, Rethinking Life and Death, The Ethics of What We Eat with Jim Mason, and most recently, The Life You Can Save, How to Do Your Part to End World Poverty, and The Expanding Circle, Ethics, Evolution, and Moral Progress. Peter has been variously described as one of the most influential people in the world, one of the leading public intellectuals in the world, and the most dangerous man on the planet. In 2004, he scrutinised Australia's ethical track record as a global citizen under five headings: foreign aid, engagement with the United Nations, trade policy, refugee policy, and action on global environmental issues. His report card then rarely rated Australia above poor, and he largely blamed what he saw as our political preoccupations with national self-interest. So, what has changed since then, if anything? And where do ethics sit in the national political debate? Please welcome Peter Singer.
Thank you very much, Jenny, for that introduction. I want to thank the National Museum for making this event possible, and of course, thank you all for turning up, which makes it more interesting than it would if you had not. So, as Jenny said, in 2004, I published a book, a co-authored book, I should acknowledge, with Tom Gregg, called How Ethical Is Australia? It was suggested to me to write this by David Yenken on behalf of something called the Australian Collaboratory, which was a group of organisations of various kinds involved with issues from NGOs that might be seen as broadly in the ethical perspective. And it was intended quite explicitly to say something about the direction that Australia was heading in under Prime Minister John Howard. I suppose you could say perhaps the idea had suggested itself to David Yenken after reading a book that I'd published a couple of years earlier called One World, which was about ethics and globalization. So the focus is specifically on Australia as a global citizen. And I say that in advance because some of you might wonder, well, why this selection of issues? Why am I not looking, for example, at Australia's relationships with its indigenous people and how we deal with that issue? Or, for that matter, social welfare arrangements within Australia. So I am looking at Australia rather in its relations with the world outside, beyond Australia. And so this is the selection of issues that I'm going to talk about tonight. Not quite the same selection as in the book. Partly time is short, but I think these are some of the more interesting issues, and of course I have looked at things that are current as well to bring that up to date. So let's look at some of these questions and why they're important ethical issues, as well as how we are doing in addressing them. And I start with climate change, not only because it's currently on the agenda, but because I do think it's one of the great ethical challenges of this century. In fact, Kevin Rudd said that early on when campaigning for office, that this was the great moral challenge of our generation, of the 21st century. I think you could well say that along with global poverty, it is indeed the great moral challenge, and therefore it is a question as to very relevant to how ethical we are as to how we deal with that. Let's just go back a little bit first, though, to set the framework for what we're trying to do here. Many of you will already know, but just to remind you, we can go back to 1992 as the beginning of international recognition that climate change is something that we need to do something about, that we need to act collectively. And there was an agreement that Australia signed on to, and indeed pretty well all the nations of the world signed on to, including the United States, that we should stabilize greenhouse gases at a level low enough to prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. That's the important phrase, to prevent something dangerous that we are causing through our activities. And I take it that there's no serious doubt that human activities are causing the climate to change. I know there's some debate about that, but it's very hard to find a scientist working in the relevant field who doesn't accept that we are contributing to climate change. How much that contribution is, there might be some debate about. But I don't take the skepticism on the science of it really very seriously. So, what's the just way of dealing with this? Well, one just way of dealing with it is to look at the atmosphere as if it's some kind of scarce commodity that everybody wants a bit of. So let's say it's a tasty-looking apple pie, as you have pictured here, and there's lots of people who would like a slice of that pie. Let's say there's 20 people who would like a slice of this pie, but some people are taking really big slices, so big that it's impossible for 20 people to have slices that big. That's really what I think is going on with the atmosphere. The atmosphere has a limited capacity to absorb some of the gases we produce, carbon dioxide and methane in particular. And yet some people are taking bigger slices of that than others can have. And we're one of them. We have about 1/300th of the world's population, and we're taking about 1/60th of a fair share. That is, by a fair share here, I mean the kind of slice that everybody could have without causing dangerous anthropogenic climate change, that formula that we agreed to at the Earth Summit in Rio in 92. So we're taking about 5 times our share, and that obviously raises an ethical issue. Can we justify doing this? It seems prima facie that we can't. Now, someone might say, well, you're assuming that the just way of distributing this is equal per capita shares throughout the world. Yes, I am going to assume that. If I was giving a full-length lecture just on this topic, I would look at a variety of other principles of justice and see whether, indeed, there are some other defensible principles of justice that might make a significant difference to the ethics of what we're doing. I'll tell you now that I don't believe there are. So that's the shortcut to the longer lecture. But we're going to have time for Q&A, so if you have a favourite principle of justice that you think would make it ethical for us to have the kind of share of the atmosphere that we're using now, I hope you'll ask me about it when it comes to question time. I'm not the only person, fortunately, who thinks that equal per capita shares is the right way to go about it. Lots of philosophers think that, and at least one heavyweight politician, political leader, thinks that. Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, has said that. And that really is, you know, Germany is also not 5 times its share, but I think, I've got a slide that will show roughly. Germany also is at least 3 times over its share. So that's a pretty tough hurdle for Germany to accept as well. But Germany's leader accepts that that's the right thing to do. Admittedly, she says, our long-term measure. She's probably thinking I'm not going to be Chancellor that long. But still, it's the kind of thing that we need to aim at. So this is the slide that I mentioned. This is the most complicated slide I'll be showing tonight, I think. You'll be pleased to know, a couple of others. It comes out of, in fact, a German government advisory committee. The WBGU stands for the German words used for that, which I won't bother you with. And what it's doing is it's saying, okay, so if we're going to prevent dangerous anthropogenic climate change, how much greenhouse gases can the world emit by 2050, 40 years on? And they calculated how much it would take. They made this phrase, dangerous anthropogenic climate change, a bit more precise by saying, let's look at the top line. How much can we emit and not go above a temperature rise, a global temperature rise, of 2 degrees Celsius with a two-thirds probability? That is, they're admitting that even on the figures that they've put up, which I'll go through in a moment, there's still a 1 in 3 chance that we will have a more than 2 degrees Celsius rise, and that is the level that they think would be dangerous in terms of producing feedback loops that make things spiral out of control and make it impossible for us to stay anywhere near 2 degrees, but maybe to rise to 4 or 6 degrees with enormous changes. So what they did is they calculated what the world can produce, that 750 figure that you see up there, 750 billion tonnes of CO2. They then looked at the 2008 emissions levels, and they said, how many years would each country have to continue with its present business-as-usual emissions before it exhausts its equal per capita share of that 750 million tonnes? And Australia is not on the list that they of examples that they gave, but we're pretty much up there with the United States. Our per capita level is not that different from the United States. So you can see that things are pretty grim. In about 6 years, just 6 years at present rates, we're going to have used up our entire budget to 2050. And so after 2017 or whatever it's going to be, we're going to have to be at zero emissions. Or if we go above zero emissions for a few years, we're going to have to be below zero. We're going to have be absorbing more than we're putting out. Very difficult to do with present technology to comply with what would be our fair share. And just by way of contrast, look at the country at the bottom of this list. Burkina Faso, a very poor African nation. Its emissions are so low at present that it could go on emitting at present rates for another 2,892 years before it used up the budget that it has till 2050. And yet it's countries like Burkina Faso that will be most affected by climate change. Of course, we'll be affected too. We're already affected. I think there's no doubt that we already have been affected by rising temperatures, more extreme weather events, more extreme droughts, and so on. And that is probably going to get worse. But even if the rains completely fail, even if, as it looked like it might happen a couple of years ago, there's no irrigation water for the entire Murray-Darling Basin, even if those farmers who rely on irrigation have to leave the land, they're not going to die. They're not going to starve to death. They'll come to Sydney or Melbourne or Canberra and they'll find work, or if they don't find work, they'll survive on a social welfare scheme that the government will continue to pay. And they'll still have decent medical care and they'll still have safe drinking water. But people in sub-Saharan Africa who rely on rainfall to produce the food that their families eat don't have those options. They will become refugees, but they won't have anywhere to go where they'll find employment, or where if they don't find employment, they'll have some kind of welfare security net to help them. So in taking more than our fair share, we are harming those who are currently using far less than their fair share. And that seems manifestly an unethical thing to do. And look how we're doing it. One of the things we're doing is we're building bigger and bigger houses, which of course take more energy to heat in winter or to cool in summer and use more resources simply to build. We have now passed the United States in terms of the average size of new homes built. So we're doing it essentially for luxuries that in no way are necessary to our survival. I don't know about the rest of you, but I grew up in a family home that had just one bathroom. And you know what? I survived. It seems that people who build new homes in Australia imagine that you can't really do that. You need a bathroom for every bedroom. So, of course, you need more resources to build it. That's the kind of luxuries that we are giving ourselves. And in doing that, we are imposing this kind of thing, not just the rainfalls failing, as I mentioned, but rising sea levels, inundating fertile delta regions of some of the world's poor countries, as here in India. You could see similar scenes in Bangladesh, for example, where very rich farmland is densely inhabited because any rich land is needed, but it's very low-lying. So as sea levels rise, they become more prone to inundation from high tides and storms. And, of course, their land is then ruined and they have to leave. So it clearly can't be ethical to do that. So that's why I think this is a real ethical measure of what we're doing. And when I wrote the book in 2004, of course, Australia was one of only two industrialized nations that had refused to sign the Kyoto Protocol. And we were not doing anything serious about reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. Fortunately, when the Rudd government came to office, it did sign Kyoto. So we isolated the United States as the only industrialized nation not to have signed onto it. But still, we didn't do anything. And we still haven't done anything, but I'm hopeful that we're about to do something anyway. That's why I welcome the carbon tax proposal, and I think we should all welcome it as something that we have an ethical obligation to do something about. I hope that in time the carbon price will rise beyond the $23 per tonne that we have now. But it will provide a mechanism to do something about it. I also welcome the fact that as a result of pressure from the Greens, we are investing more in research and development of clean, renewable energy. It's a scandal that Australia is not in the forefront of solar energy production, given the sun we get and the land we have available to use it. So that's certainly something that could be globally important, not only important for ourselves, and something that we ought to be doing. And I welcome also the fact that we have now at least set, although the target that Julia Gillard talks about, 5% reduction by 2020, is a modest target by 2020. We are at least talking now, as the Europeans are doing, about very serious reductions by 2050. In other words, we've recognized that we need to do the kind of thing that was shown in that German Advisory Council report, and we've set a target of an 80% reduction by 2050, and I hope we do get serious about meeting that target, because the world certainly needs something like that. So this is one area where I think we are doing significantly better, and we'll be able to say, assuming that the carbon tax goes through, as I hope it will, we'll then be able to put a tick here and we'll say, well, we're now on the side of doing reasonably well on this crucial moral issue, whereas previously we were among the worst offenders on that score. Okay. One other way of looking at what we're doing, incidentally, has been suggested as a kind of aggression against countries that can't protect themselves. This is a quote from President Museveni of Uganda, who has seen this not just as taking more than our fair share, but is actually committing a kind of aggression against other nations that are going to be harmed much more by climate change than those nations like us, like the United States, like Europe, that are contributing much more to it. One thing that, just to register a quick complaint about, that the carbon tax scheme does not do is that it does not count agriculture. And that's a pity, because agriculture is a very important contributor to Australia's greenhouse gas emissions. In fact, it's an important contributor to world greenhouse gas emissions, as the Food and Agriculture Organization said a few years ago, larger than transport, livestock emissions. And the chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change asked people to eat less meat because it's a very carbon-intensive commodity. But it's a big loophole, a big gap in the scheme proposed. And whether we're talking about feedlot beef or grass-fed beef, it doesn't really matter here. Some people have the illusion that it's only the American-style feedlot beef that emits a lot of greenhouse gases. Not true. When cattle digest grass, they actually emit more methane per kilo of meat that is produced than when they're eating grain. So it doesn't really help to point out that most of Australia's cattle are on grass, or at least on grass for longer than cattle in some other parts of the world. Okay, I want to move now to the other second issue that I talked about, global poverty. This is something on which the world is making progress. This 2010 figure of 8.1 million children under five dying from preventable poverty-related causes is a terrible figure. But if you pick up a copy of my book, The Life You Can Save, you'll see that it has come down even since the paperback was published just a couple of years ago when it was 8.8 million. And if you had the hardback, you'd see it was something like 9.8 million. So we're actually making pretty steady progress on this. But of course we should be when you consider what we're talking about. Millions of avoidable deaths, preventable deaths that we know how to prevent, not from mysterious diseases we can't cure, deaths from things like diarrhea, pneumonia, malaria, measles that people don't die from here, related to poor sanitation and hygiene, related to lack of medical care. They're things that we can prevent, and with more assistance, more aid, we would prevent more of them. And if this was not happening distributed around the world, but if it was happening in one place, imagine 20,000 children in a football stadium, and they were going to die unless we gave them some assistance, let's say by the end of the week. That would be the major media story, of course, and we would all rush to give assistance. But because it's happening in a dispersed way that the media doesn't capture, it continues. It continues at a rate that I think is a sign that we are not acting ethically towards people in remote countries elsewhere in the world. How is Australia doing? Here's a chart from the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It's a bit complicated, but a couple of the things that I wanted to point out. Don't worry about the figures at the top for the moment because I've got another slide that shows them. Most of our aid goes to the region. If you look at the top countries here, it's Indonesia, New Guinea, Solomon Islands, Iraq, and Afghanistan. They're countries in which we have political interests. They're not necessarily the most impoverished countries in the world. So our aid is skewed politically. And then Iraq and Afghanistan, obviously, we have political interests. Iraq in particular is not really an especially poor country. It's a lower middle-income country. But obviously the aid goes there because we think we're helping the war against terrorism by doing that. Compare that with Sweden, which both gives a lot more aid, and I'll come to that too in a moment, but also gives aid much more to countries in sub-Saharan Africa, and countries where actual extreme poverty is the reason why these countries are on this list. But let's also look at the amounts of aid that are being given. Here's a comparison of Australian aid and Swedish aid, ODA over GNI, official development assistance as a percentage of gross national income, which is a reasonable measure of how generous the countries are, with one qualification that I'll come to in a moment. So Australian aid is the line down the bottom. At the time that I did the book, it was only, I think, 0.2 or 2, something like that. And it's risen slightly since started rising the year before the Rudd government took office. has been rising, fell off in 2009 and rose back again in 2010, where it's currently at 0.32%. In other words, for every $100 this nation earns, we give 32 cents in official development assistance. Not very much for one of the wealthiest nations in the world. Sweden is no wealthier than we are, but it gives substantially more. As you can see, it actually went above 1%, went to 1.1%, and then has dropped back in the last year to 0.97%. Still close to 1%. So about three times as well as we are doing. Although, as I say, not really a wealthier nation than we are. So the United Nations many years ago recommended 0.7% as a target for countries to reach. We're well below that. Now, on the brighter side, there is bipartisan support in Australia now for reaching 0.5%, 50 cents in every $100 we earn. The Gillard government is committed to it, the Rudd government was committed to it, and Tony Abbott has said that he supports it as well. So that's encouraging, although you do have to ask why 0.5 rather than at least the UN target of 0.7. Why can't we get up there with, I think it's about five or six countries in the world that have met or passed that, and Britain has committed to meeting it, I think it's something that we should commit to at least as well. I said, well, there's one minor qualification with the gap between us and Sweden, and that is that we give a little more non-government aid than Sweden does. In other words, the non-government sector, the voluntary sector, is larger here. One of the reasons for that is that we can get a tax deduction when we donate to foreign aid. In Sweden, you can't. So that's probably a factor. May also be that the Swedes just have more of a tradition of expecting their government to do more and doing less on a voluntary basis. But it doesn't make much difference on that chart. If you add in, it's about $800 million a year that is given privately, and the figure that we're talking about here is something like $4.5 to $4.8 billion. So you add another 0.8 of a billion, and it's going to put it up a bit, but it's not going to put it anywhere near Sweden or even anywhere near the 0.7. So how are we doing on this? We're doing a little better than we were. We're hoping to do better still, but we're not doing nearly well enough, I would say. Okay, quickly I want to say something about asylum seekers, which in a way is an internal issue, but obviously relates to the way we deal with people from abroad and with our adherence to international conventions. This is something that I think we were doing very badly when we wrote the other book. The Rudd government was elected on a promise to do better. Has it done better? Well, maybe it's doing a little bit better, but it's not doing very much better. There's two separate issues here, I think. One is, how do we deal with people who come to our shores claiming asylum in terms of accepting them or not, and how do we deal in terms of accepting refugees in general? And a second question is, what do we do with them while we decide how we're dealing with them? So the second issue is the issue of mandatory detention. And that's something that I had hoped that we would have finished with by now, but unfortunately we haven't. Although certainly there are fewer people in detention now than there were, and that's welcome, and there's quite recently a move to release more families and unaccompanied minors to community detention. So I think that's something that we should be doing more of. But the question of how we deal with asylum seekers in general, I think, is an issue in which, in a sense, while we haven't got a lot better, the rest of the world has got somewhat worse, and I'm no longer as confident as I was back in 2004 in saying that there is a clear solution to this problem. Because I do think it's become clearer now that we have an industry that is trying to help people get into countries that are more desirable, some of whom at least are not genuine asylum seekers. And I think that's an issue that clearly does have to be dealt with, and so we need procedures for doing that. And to that extent, I think the basic idea behind the Malaysian deal that was arranged recently is a sound one. That is, take more refugees who are in the queue, who've been in refugee camps for a long time, rather than admit people to Australia who can, if they go somewhere like Malaysia where they can get processed, and if they are genuine refugees, then they at least will be safe from persecution in their own country, and they can wait their turn in the queue until they can get taken somewhere else. So it takes away the attractiveness of going to Australia, even if you're not a genuine refugee, in the hope that you will be able to stay there. And while there's problems about the fact that Malaysia is not a signatory to the International Convention on Refugees, the basic idea that we should take more genuine refugees who have been waiting for years in refugee camps, I think is a positive. I think we could raise the number of refugees we're taking quite easily, and that's a separate matter from how we deal with people who actually land on our shores and claim asylum. Obviously, that's far too brief a discussion. Let me just say a little about this issue, which, because there's been so much attention paid to it, I think that we do have a responsibility to see that when we export animals, they are treated in a way similar to how they would be treated in Australia. So I think the live export trade is something that we should properly be ashamed of when we learn how the animals were treated. Now, the footage from Indonesia showing the cattle that were killed there was shocking and obviously disturbed a lot of Australians, and the government responded by suspending the live export trade. I think that was the right thing to do. I think the government has now yielded to pressure from the cattle growers and has rescinded the ban with some conditions, but I don't believe that the conditions are anything like adequate to ensure that these kinds of things are not going to happen once our cattle arrive back in Indonesia again. I think we should be moving to substitute a carcass trade for a live trade. I think that's probably the only way to really ensure that animals are humanely handled. And incidentally, it's not only the recent revelations of the cattle, the killing and handling of cattle in Indonesia that should trouble us. There's also, for a long time, has been the export of live sheep to the Middle East. And although the footage there from there has not caused the same kind of stir, at least recently, that the cattle trade did, this is a larger trade which is continuing, and where, again, there is quite inhumane handling and killing of Australian sheep in the Middle East. And I think that if we want to consider ourselves an ethical nation, we should not be permitting this to continue either. So I'll leave it there. I know that I was very brief on some very big issues, but we are going to have a chance for discussion and Q&A, so I look forward to hearing from you then. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter. A lot of questions I have, but I'm not going to take up all the time with them, so I'm sure there are a lot of questions you all have as well. What I'd like to ask you first is a question about realpolitik, which you mentioned at the beginning when you were talking about an equal share of missions and Angela Merkel's comment from Germany about how this was a long-term goal. And you said, of course, she won't be in government or probably won't be in power at that time. I just wonder how you see ethics balancing with the reality of the politics of some of these things. And we can take each of them apart a little bit. But in general, it's easy to say ideally what we would all like, but how does politics sit with ethics? reality of politics.
Right. Well, clearly politics has an uneasy relationship with ethics, because there is a reality of politics, and if you're not in power, you can't do anything. So any government can say, if this policy will lead to us no longer being in power, then it's not a policy that we ought to follow, no matter how ethical it might be, because we won't be in power, we won't be able to carry it out. The other mob will come in and they won't do it. So we have to make compromises in order to get closer to doing the right thing, but still remain in office. I think that's what typically goes on. But the only way we can shift that to make governments able to do the right thing is if we have a sufficiently educated electorate that understands what is the right thing and cares about what's the right thing and will vote for governments to do the right thing. So that's really what we need. We need an electorate that understands all of these issues. And I think, you know, the extent to which that happens varies from country to country. I think Sweden's high level of aid can be a result of the fact that Sweden is a country where people are highly educated, follow what their government does, and it seems to me are concerned about their government doing the right thing. The United States is much less so, and that's why there isn't a carbon tax or anything like it even seriously on the political agenda at the moment in the United States. And we're probably somewhere in between those two extremes.
But aside from doing the right thing, there are also real human considerations in the ethics of some of this. There are people's jobs, there are people's livelihoods that are at stake with implementing some of the ethical principles that you are talking about. I mean, how does a government balance that? How does politics find a way through that to achieve the things sometimes that politicians might want to achieve on both sides?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, they're looking at people who are going to be put out of work as a result of a decision, or industries that are going to shut down, or export income that's going to disappear.
Right. It's difficult for them, but if the electorate understands that, let's say, some jobs in the coal industry or at coal-driven power generators have to go, and if they don't go, we're going to be causing hundreds of millions of people, or perhaps billions of people, to lose the way they produce food and to become refugees, then, you know, obviously we have to do the best we can to find these people other jobs and to help ease the adjustment from their loss of employment. But I don't think you can really count, you should count it certainly, but if you weigh the loss of jobs in the power industry in Australia as against vastly larger numbers of people perhaps starving or certainly losing their land, or for that matter entire nations going under the waves, as we know will happen with some of the small Pacific nations like Tuvalu and Kiribati, not so many people there, but still entire nations disappearing. I think you have to accept that there are going to have to be some sacrifices made by Australians, and what we just need to do is to try and make sure they're made across the community as a whole and not just on some small number of people.
When you were talking about refugees and asylum seekers and the idea of an offshore solution to that and Malaysia, I wonder where you think our ethical responsibility to those people begins and ends in that scenario.
Our ethical responsibility to the asylum seekers?
Yes.
I think our ethical responsibility to the asylum seekers is, firstly, not to return them to a place where they may be in danger of being killed or persecuted, but it's also not necessarily to accept them into Australia. It's to see that they can be somewhere safe while claims are being considered. I mean, part of the whole issue here, really, it's good to step back a little bit and ask, why do we have a specific law about asylum seekers, right? Why does the fact that you can actually set foot in Australia give you a claim that's any better than the claim that you have if you're a refugee in a refugee camp anywhere in the world? And I think that's a kind of historical tradition that we don't turn away people who claim asylum. But I think really the only responsibility is not to return them to where they're going to be persecuted. I say this, by the way, as somebody who's the son of people who came to Australia as refugees. And obviously, you know, the worst thing to do to my parents would have been to send them back to Nazi Germany. But I don't think they could have really complained if Australia had said, we're not going to send you back, but you know, we're going to make sure that you're safe and there's somewhere you can stay, and it, not necessarily Australia. You know, they would have been vastly better off anyway there than had they had to stay in Nazi Germany. So I think that's the world responsibility. And in my view, the ethical question that we're not raising enough is how many refugees can we take? What contribution can we make to the refugee problem? I think we should be taking larger numbers of refugees, but not necessarily every asylum seeker who sets foot in our shores.
Mm. So if we send them to a place which might have different standards to our standards in terms of housing them, keeping them, do we still have an ethical responsibility to them when they're in another country waiting for a decision?
Well, I mean, as I said, my doubts are that Malaysia is not a signatory to the International Convention, but and I'm not sufficiently expert on what the conditions actually are to know. But if the conditions are that they will be safe, that they will be provided with the necessities of life, although the housing conditions may be poor and not what they would have got if they got to Australia, I think that meets our responsibilities. As long as we're taking sufficient number of refugees to help deal with the global refugee problem, which, as we know, is many millions of people.
Mm. So is that more important, the taking of extra numbers?
Yes.
In the global refugee
problem? I see that as making more of a contribution to the overall problem of refugees and asylum seekers combined.
Mm. Where do you see ethics in the Australian political scene?
Look, I think it plays a role. As I said, I think Australians are concerned about the nation being one that can hold its head up and do the right thing. And I think that, therefore, it does play a role. And I think the bipartisan nature of increasing our foreign aid reflects the idea that that's something that Australians want to do. We want to be on a par with other nations of comparable wealth in terms of playing a role there. So I think it does play some role, but unfortunately I don't think it plays enough of a role, obviously. It doesn't have the weight that I would like it to have.
Mm. I would like to ask you some of the questions that that were received online by the museum, because a few of them are relevant to some of the issues that you raised in your talk. There's one question from Confused, is the name of the person, who asks the question, in the last few weeks, the ABC's Four Corners has shown two programs on horrific brutality against cattle and against Tamils. From the public outcry, Australians seem to be far more concerned about the cattle. What's your understanding of the ethics at work behind this stark difference? And the questioner says it's very disturbing.
Well, I mean, obviously, both those cases, those who are not familiar with it, the brutality that's referred to against the Tamils was the brutality shown by the Sri Lankan army as they retook the area that had been held by the Tamil Tigers. Obviously, these are, you know, I think both what's been done to Australian cattle in Indonesia and what's been done to Tamils are shocking things that ought not to happen. And we ought to do whatever we can to stop those things happening. But in the case of the cattle, because these cattle were coming to us from Australia, it's very easy to say what Australia should do to stop that. We should not allow our cattle to be exported to countries that do not use the same humane standards of treatment and slaughter that we do. If you say, what should Australia have done, or, I mean, even let alone what would Australia now do, because the brutality of the Tamils is not now continuing. It was a program that looked at something that had happened. So in a way, I would say one reason that there was less outrage was not that viewers did not regard this as a terrible thing, but rather this was an atrocity that has occurred and that we can't do anything about now. And even if we had known of it occurring when it was occurring, there would have been relatively little that we could have done as compared to the live export things. So I think the underlying ethics here are quite realistic ethics in saying we ought to be concerned about things where we as a nation, through our government or as individuals, can make a difference. Other things are terrible, but there's not much point in getting all that outraged about them if we're powerless to make any difference.
Mm. So you see it in terms of power rather than humans versus animals?
I don't see it in terms of us being more concerned about humans than... more concerned about animals than about humans, no. I'm sure that if, there'd been a Four Corners program about Australian troops somewhere, let's say in Afghanistan, carrying out those kinds of atrocities that the Sri Lankan army was shown as carrying out, there would have been much more outrage than there was about the live export of cattle.
Mm. And is that an issue, ethically, that we relate more strongly to our own people than we do to people from another land, in terms of human rights?
No, I think we should be concerned about brutality and suffering wherever it occurs. But the point is, it's not just that it's people from our land or cattle from our land, it's can we do something about this? And, of course, we are in control of the cattle that are exported, at least until they're exported. We are in control of what the Australian troops do, wherever they are in the world. And so, rightly, we pay more attention to that because that's where we can make a difference.
I'd like to put another question to you from Angus, who asks, Australia is a democratic plural society formed by many different cultures and people. Each of these cultures and people has their own belief systems with specific ethical standards, and often what is judged right for one section of society can be judged wrong for another. How can we come to a single ethical judgment on an issue, such as abortion, for example, and place that into law without excluding many different belief systems? Does public policy always need to be made in a secular manner that excludes citizens' spiritual beliefs?
Yeah, that's a good question that raises a large issue, obviously. I think that when we have ethical debates about what the laws should be or what our government should do, we have to have those debates in ways whereby we can communicate across the political spectrum or across the public debate. In other words, there's something that's sometimes called the public square. That is, when we're speaking in the arena of discourse where we want to influence government policies and laws, we have to be able to say things from a position that others can accept. And if I say abortion is wrong, and you ask me why, and I say, because here in Scripture it says that it's wrong, and that's not a Scripture that you regard as an authority, then clearly I'm not going to be able to convince you. So I think that's not an argument that really ought to be given weight in terms of deciding government policy. On the other hand, of course, you can argue, as in fact, most people, irrespective of their religious persuasion, do try to argue that abortion is the killing of a human being and that the killing of a human being is wrong. And I think you can have a debate about that claim, and I have had that debate on many occasions, and I've written about it in a couple of my works, Practical Ethics and Rethinking Life and Death. And I think, in fact, you can show that abortion is not ethically wrong. So I think you can show that on the basis of rational argument and examination. Now, it's not, therefore, I think, just a matter of saying, well, here's my community of belief and they think that, and here's your community of belief and they think that, and there's no way that they can communicate with each other. I think once you're prepared to look at arguments that don't presuppose some specific set of religious beliefs, then you can have a good discussion and you can hope to persuade some people. Mm.
And do you think that applies to broader culture as well, if you take religion away and just look at cultural difference? Because that's, I think, a very interesting question around different cultural beliefs and how you come to an ethical position across a range of different cultural approaches to an issue.
But I think the ethical issues are maybe a little bit different because we need to make laws about them and we can't just say, well, everybody do their own thing, right? I mean, I suppose you could say, You might say, well, you have a law on abortion where those who think that abortion is okay can have abortions and those who think that abortion is wrong won't have abortions. But you couldn't have that on every possible kind of thing. If some people think, for example, that it's okay to treat some people in ways that other people think is wrong, you know, there are certain things that we don't accept. We don't accept, for example, female genital mutilation, even if some cultures think that that's an acceptable practice. So I think the question when you talk about different cultures is it something that is having an impact where we think that we need to rightly make this a matter of public policy? If it's a matter of, you know, what kind of traditions or celebrations do you have, well, obviously we can allow people to do their own thing there.
Mm. Your report card from 2004, I mean, how would you summarise the way that you view Australia now in terms of that question compared to the way you viewed it in 2004?
Well, I mean, at the moment, I think we're certainly better than 2004. You read out those categories of the poll that people have taken part in. So I certainly don't think we're in the doing well category yet. I suppose I'm a little undecided as to whether in the poor or the could try harder category. And if the carbon tax goes through, I might be inclined to put us in the could try harder category, that is, I see as the better category than the poor category. At the moment, still not effectively doing anything about carbon. I think we're still in the poor category. But we are about to do something, and we are also increasing our aid, and I hope that will continue. So we're getting, you know, we're certainly moved up a few notches. If we had a more sensitive kind of scale out of 10, I would say we've moved from 3 or 4 in the 2004 scale to something like maybe 5 or 6 now.
Mm. Interestingly, one of the things that comes up about the carbon tax again and again is the question of a promise being made that there would be no carbon tax before an election and then a decision to introduce a carbon tax after that election. Ethical?
No, it's a pity that Julia Gillard felt obliged to make that promise. I've said I welcome the fact that there is going to be, I hope, a carbon tax. I regret the fact that she's debased the currency of political promises once again. She's certainly not the first politician to have done that. But it would have been better if she'd been more prepared to be tough and say, as she's now saying, that we need and should have a carbon tax.
Mm. So it's unethical to have made that promise?
I think it's unethical to have made the promise. I'm not saying it's unethical now to go ahead with the tax because I think it's sometimes justifiable to break a promise where you're going to do much more good by breaking it than you would do by keeping it, and I think that's one of those cases.
Oh, that's interesting. So you think that's...
I don't think there's any absolute obligation to keep promises, clearly. I mean, I think we all accept that, really. You know, I've promised to meet you for lunch, but on my way I come across an accident and I happen to be medically trained. I can save the life of someone there, but I'm going to have to break my promise that I made that I won't be late for our 1 o'clock appointment. Obviously, everybody thinks that I should break the promise. So there's a kind of an unspoken condition on promises. And I guess in this case, I think we ought to excuse Julia Gillard for breaking the promise and be thankful that she has seen the light about the importance of doing something about Australia's emissions.
I'd like to take questions. Who would like to ask a question? If you could put your hands up, we'll get a microphone to you. And if you could just tell us your name before you ask the question. Yes.
Good evening, Professor Singer. My name's Jeanette Condon. I'd like to ask you about your views on Australia's population growth, specifically in relation, when you said we should take more refugees, do you mean we should take a lot more? Should we take a greater percentage of our existing intake of immigration? And how do we balance this with concerns that a lot of people raise about the impact on Australia's environment of a fragile environment and so on, and our lack of fertile land? There seem to be a number of ethical issues in that
yes.
That proposal.
Thank you, Jeanette, for raising that important question. To answer first your point about refugees, I think refugees should be a larger share of our existing intake of immigrants. It's a separate question whether we ought to increase the intake of immigrants. I also think that we should not be encouraging Australians to have large families, because I think that not only Australia but the world as a whole has a population problem, and increasingly will have one on current projections, which now take us to 10 billion by 2050. So we shouldn't be contributing to that issue anymore. But I think we can have a sustainable population in Australia, which might still edge up somewhat, but I hope would stabilise at some time in the not too distant future, and still take significantly more refugees than we are presently taking.
Other questions? Yes, up the back here.
Hi, Professor Singer. My name's Adriana, and thank you so much for all you've had to say. Given what you've said about the disproportionate effects of climate change on poorer nations and also our poor efforts in giving foreign aid to poorer nations that really deserve it, do you think that there is an obligation to try and extend the Refugee Convention and our laws to encompass economic and environmental refugees?
I think that if you do broaden the situation to that extent, then the numbers of refugees worldwide are going to get much larger than they are, and I don't really think it's going to help, given that already we have, I think it's maybe around 10 million refugees in refugee camps. I don't think it's going to really help, because what you need is for countries to take refugees. Just changing the convention is not really going to make the difference. And I think, incidentally, we're going to get, as I said, a lot more refugees when climate change kicks in some places. And you could argue that we'll have a greater obligation to take them because we've actually caused their plight. We've caused the fact that they become refugees. So I think the refugee problem is going to grow, and I think we need to look at ways of trying to resettle refugees, and it's a really difficult issue, and I don't think broadening the category of refugees under the convention is really going to be what is going to solve that problem.
Hmm. Other questions? Yes. Gentleman up the front here. Could anyone else put up their hands so we can get over there? Right. I'll come to you in a moment.
Hello, Professor Singer. I'm William Mudford. My question gets to the nub of what I think other people are asking is, how do you ethically decide who gets to come to a particular place in the world, this being Australia?
Ideally, you would ethically decide by how long they've been waiting in a refugee camp. We would. I think it's ethical to say you've been in a refugee camp. There's no question that you're a bona fide refugee. You've been waiting there for a long time, and you're the next one who ought to be taken. That seems to me the fairest system. And if you take people out of the refugee camps who've been there a long time, then the camps will have more room for other people who become refugees. I don't really think it's relevant that people have managed to set foot in Australia or even get into Australian territorial waters. I think that's a historical understanding that is now becoming something of an anachronism. But as I say, our obligations to those people are to ensure that they're safe, that they don't go, that they're not sent back to their countries where they will be persecuted. But just the fact that they've managed to get into our territorial waters, I don't see gives them a moral claim to be taken that's any greater, or indeed I would say is less, than the moral claims of families who've been in a refugee camp elsewhere in the world for several years.
Does that answer your question, or were you thinking more about relative suffering and relative situations?
Right. So I think there's... sorry, I'll repeat that question because probably people... William said he was thinking more about the general question of who comes to Australia, not just refugees. So we've had immigration policies that are in part humanitarian, like the refugee programs and for asylum seekers who we judge to be bona fide, We've had a family reunion policy, and we've had people who come with needed skills that can contribute to the country. I think that the family reunion policy has been important, and you could justify as having humane purposes, particularly when there was a large flow of immigrants wanting to bring families with them who had unite families. I think it's less significant now. And I think that if we are concerned about Australia's population growth, then we shouldn't really be focusing that much on people with useful skills. I think if there are opportunities in the country for employment, then we ought to be training people here, and that will include refugees who we bring here out of refugee camps who can fill those opportunities. So I think we have a different issue about to what extent do we think we can sustainably allow our population to grow. And I agree that there's problems with doing, too much growth. But within whatever limit we decide, I think we ought to be taking more refugees and training them to develop the skills we need, rather than taking people who are doing perfectly fine in the countries where they're living, but would like to come to Australia and get in because they have these skills.
Gentleman over here, yes.
Thank you. My name's Richard Arculus. I'd like to ask you, Professor, the globe does pretty well with some issues like eradication of smallpox, and we had a major success with getting rid of the CFCs and the destruction of the ozone layer. What do you think is so difficult about carbon dioxide and the other greenhouse gases that a large proportion of the globe, including this country, percentage of the population, fail to understand what the issue is and won't take the ethical approach that you're advocating?
I think that what's different about the climate change issue is that it actually does require much more dramatic changes to our lives than either of the other two cases that you mentioned. Smallpox eradication required quite a modest amount of aid to do it once we had the understanding of how to do it, and no dislocation to our lives. The CFCs problem, the chlorofluorocarbons, which was agreed to in the Montreal Protocol to phase out, we had good alternatives to them. There were very minor dislocations in some industries that had produced them, but we had other ways of doing the various functions that CFCs did. Carbon is a much bigger problem. At the moment, generally speaking, we don't have other ways of producing energy that are as cheap as the dirty ways of producing energy that we use now, particularly coal. Our energy is going to have to become more expensive. And that, that's the debate we've been having. Are we going to have higher bills to heat our house, to do a variety of other things? And obviously the Gillard government feels it can only do that if it compensates people at significant cost, particularly the poorer sections of the community, in order to do that. The other problem that's even harder to deal with, and as I said, the Gillard government isn't even proposing to deal with, is emissions from agriculture, particularly those methane emissions from livestock. I won't go into the details, but by some ways of calculating the impact of methane, you could reach a figure where Australia's cattle and sheep produce as much damaging greenhouse gases as all of our coal-fired power plants. It's a bit controversial how you do those calculations, but it is a very significant contributor, and there's no alternative there. CSIRO are working on some kind of feed supplement that you give to cattle that will produce less methane, or breeding cattle that produce less methane, but so far they don't seem to have come up with anything. So if we're really going to stop that, we're going to have to get rid of or dramatically reduce one of our major industries with no real alternative employment obvious for those people. And we're going to have to change our diet as well, insofar as people are eating beef and lamb. So I think those factors also make it clear why this is a more difficult task for people to face up to. And so, I think you said, why don't they understand the ethics of it? I think it's because self-interest is a powerful distorter of the way we view ethics. And that's why I think there's more denial and obfuscation about what's really happening than on those other issues.
So in those terms, how do you deal with a public debate about it?
It's tough. I mean, it's tough, but you have to get people to see that life can go on, that we don't really need to be consuming nearly as much energy as we are, that we can insulate our houses better, we can build more sustainable homes, we can drive less and cycle or walk more. You know, there's a whole range of different things that we can do and I believe should be doing, and they're not really going to make us miserable. But it's going to take time to get people to adjust. And the beef and lamb issue is a whole other question, which we're also, I think, going to have to take a long time to get people to adjust to that.
Mm. Yes, hands going up everywhere. We'll come down here, then over there, and then here. So here first.
Professor, you've made the comment that the Australian public needs to be better educated and to be better educated ethically. But the biggest issue is that our main form of education is the media. And going on the issues we've had recently with ethics in the media, how do we resolve that issue and provide ethical education?
Yes, very difficult. Well, let me first say I'm thankful that we have some non-commercial media, particularly SBS and the ABC, that do provide some balance and are not swayed to the extent that others are by either the need to grab as much audience share as possible or by the commercial interests that are sponsoring them.
And don't do phone hacking.
I have your assurance,
is
absolutely. That right, SBS, that does no phone hacking? Very good. I'm delighted to hear it. So that's important. Otherwise, it is really difficult to cope with the media that we've got. We should be supporting those media that are more responsible. Perhaps the internet is making some difference, but I'm a bit ambivalent about that. You know, it gives us more alternative sources, but maybe it also puts us all in our silos. So, you know, we look at what we want to look on the internet, and we're not forced to confront the whole spectrum of news and stories that are going on. So I don't really know. I can't say that I have a better answer to this, except let's try to do more to bolster non-commercial media in this country.
Mm. Question over here, yes. I need to
Good
look
evening,
over
Professor
here to
Singer.
Wave
My name is Ibi Loshans, and my question is regarding refugees, asylum seekers, and the concept of a queue. As you mentioned it before, the number of UNHCR-mandated refugees in the world, currently 14 million, and it is less than a couple of percent of them that actually will get resettlement. Somewhat larger will repatriate, and the rest of them just live in refugee camps for 20, 30 years. Can we, given these numbers, can we really honestly talk of the concept of a queue? And also, is it ethical for us to use this so-called concept of a queue as the focal point of the policy discourse that we are having in this country or the policy decision?
Well, thank you for the question and for the figures. You're obviously more expert in the area than I am. Can I ask you, if we can give you the microphone back, I saw it got removed. Can I ask you how you would see an ethical allocation, if not in terms of the length of time that people have spent in camps, what would you see as a more ethical way? Assuming we're talking about the same number of people that we're going to accept, what would you see as a more ethical way of deciding who should get in and who should not get in?
If I would know the answer, I would have finished my PhD by now. But, but maybe we just have to actually move out from this concept that the only thing we can do for these people is resettlement. Because given that only a couple of percent of them who will resettle, we may actually need to think.
I don't accept that way of thinking, you see. I mean, that's a bit like people saying, when I suggest that they could increase their personal contribution to Oxfam or Save the Children or one of those organisations that are helping people, they're saying, well, what can I do? You know, you've just told me there's 8 million children dying every year. You know, I'm not Bill Gates. I could, you know, maybe save 5, 10, 20, but that's a drop in the ocean. I think that's the wrong way to think about it. You could save 5 or 10 or 20 human lives. You could, you know, 10 or 20 or 40 parents, you could save the life of their child. That's a huge difference to what you can do. And it doesn't matter that there's, I mean, of course it matters, but it's not a reason for not doing it that there are those 8 million that you can't help. And similarly, it's not a reason for us not to take 10,000 or 20,000 or 50,000, whatever we decide we can do, refugees from refugee camps, that there's still going to be 14 million there. I think the good that we do to those individuals and those families is what's important.
Mm. We had a question here. Yes, and I'm sorry, it's really hard to see through that. We'll come to you next. Anyone else on this side like to ask a question? Hands up. Okay, come to you next too.
Good evening, Mr. Singer. My name's Isabel Mudford. I have a question about the live export trade. There's been a little bit of talk about religious practices over slaughtering and what happens in Indonesia with the live export trade. I'm not entirely sure, mostly halal, but I'm not entirely sure of the exact practices. But do you believe that we should take into consideration humans' religious beliefs as much as we may do if an animal's welfare is at stake?
Firstly, let me say that I don't think that what people saw on Four Corners is only the result of the fact that these animals were being slaughtered by the halal method. I think ritual slaughter can take place in a way that is far less inhumane than what was shown on Four Corners.
With now, stunning and things like that. I mean, would you consider that more ethical, to stun an animal?
Okay, that's somewhat different. So with halal, because there's not one sort of, there's no Pope of Islam, so there's no single doctrine. Some Islamic authority says that you cannot stun. Some Islamic authority says that you can stun simultaneously with the cutting of the throat. And if you stun simultaneously with the cutting of the throat, it's effectively equivalent, I think, to stunning. Although there's some questions about the positioning of the animal that may be not quite so good. But that's one issue. The other issue is, if you do have ideal halal or kosher slaughter, because kosher slaughter also requires that the animal be conscious, is that acceptable? I mean, in a way, that was what your question was asking. Is that acceptable because that's some people's religious beliefs? And I have to say, my answer to that is no. There was a measure put to the Dutch Parliament recently, which I believe has passed the lower house of the Dutch Parliament, but has not passed the upper house as yet, to prohibit ritual slaughter, or to prohibit slaughter without stunning in the Netherlands. And I support that measure. Obviously, it gets a lot of opposition from both Muslim and Jewish communities. But after all, it's not that it's religiously required for them to eat meat. So nobody is forcing them to violate their religious beliefs. All that it says is, if you are going to eat meat, it has to be from an animal that is humanely killed by the most humane methods available. Kosher and halal slaughter may have been more humane than other methods thousands of years ago, but they're certainly not now. So I think it's reasonable to say that animals should not suffer more than necessary because of someone's religious belief.
So what do you regard as the most humane method?
The most humane method is for stunning to occur before the animal is killed, which is required in this country and in most other developed countries for a slaughter that is not in accordance with a religious ritual.
Mm. Does that answer your question? Yes, over here. There was a lady with her hand up there.
Thank you. My name's Caroline. My question, Professor Singer, is about the right to privacy, particularly given the internet, phone hacking and new means of communications. Do we have an ethical right to privacy?
Good question.
It is a good question, and it's one that's become vastly more complicated in many ways, as you say, because of those things. I mean, because of the internet, in part. I don't regard privacy, I have to say, as a really somehow basic right. I think it's something that we like to have, that it gives us some security. We don't want our personal affairs to be public to all the world. There's things that we want to do that's private. But there are also, as we were talking about with breaking promises, there are also occasions where it's justified to violate privacy in the name of some greater good. And I think some of the cases that people are troubled about are cases where actually we are giving our consent by using devices. For example, if you use Google to do your searches, Google keeps that information. It keeps information on what searches you've made. And actually it links them to your IP address and stores that information, I think, currently for 6 months. So if you're searching for porn, Google knows that you're searching for porn and it's trackable back to you for 6 months anyway. After
but
that,
what if you don't know that?
Well, I mean, it's on Google's website. You know, they have a privacy policy. You can look at it. Now, you might say, well, nobody told me that. You could say they should be more upfront about it. It should be not just on their website, but it should be on the main Google search page or something like that. Yeah, maybe so. You know, the same is true with your mobile phones, in a way. Your mobile phone companies can record not just calls you're making, but where you are. So, you know, if you can tell your employer that you're sick because the surf's good, your employer might think that you're sick, but your mobile phone company knows that you're down at the beach. So,
I'm really interested that you say that you don't know that we have an ethical right, or you don't know that we have some sort of, you know, right to privacy from an ethical stance. I mean, where does that leave us if we
well,
don't
what
have
what I'm saying is I think we waive these rights, you know. I mean, you could argue that this ought to be better known, that the mobile phone companies ought to make it more public, that these records exist. But I think most of us would choose to waive those rights when we would choose to waive them, even if we did know about it. And some people, you know, I know about it, and I still use Google. I find it a better search engine than others that may not store that data. I haven't actually bothered to investigate whether there are others that don't store that data. You know, I think that...
If you don't value a right to privacy, though, does it not open the door on a whole lot of other awful things?
Such as?
Well, not being able to have privacy in your own home. Not having the right to privacy in a whole range of personal situations. I mean, is there not a case for valuing privacy?
Well, look, I think we do value privacy and there's a case for valuing it, but to say that it's a right is to sort of suggest that it's something more basic and in a way more impregnable, that it should not be overridden for the sake of great interest. So, yeah, we have a right to privacy in our homes, but if the police have good reason to believe that in our homes we're conspiring to murder people or smuggle drugs or something of that sort, they can get a bug put in our home and they can listen to our conversations. And I think that's perfectly reasonable.
Mm. Does that answer your question or do you want to follow it up? No? You happy with that? Yes. Someone else on this side had a question. Gentleman here.
Hi, Peter. My name's James. We've been talking a lot about asylum seekers and the environment and that kind of stuff, and these are all sort of truly global issues. And we've talked about Australia's response to that. But I just wonder what you think into the future, in the coming sort of, you know, decades and centuries, whether, you know, humanity as a whole can really effectively deal with these sort of issues on a state-by-state sort of basis, or whether, you know, organisations like the EU and the UN and these sort of global organisations are really what's needed to deal with these sort of global issues effectively. So, you know, can individual states acting in isolation deal with this sort of thing effectively, or is the future of politics some sort of stateless world?
I discussed this in the book I mentioned earlier, One World. I think we need to move towards more global governance. That means more institutions that have authority, that do some governing and that are global. Climate change is a classic example where we really need some kind of authority that has some powers to sanction countries that are exceeding their global share and not doing anything about it. I mean, the real problem, you know, it's one of the things why I think it's important for Australia to have some sort of carbon tax is because it will help to isolate the United States. The real problem at the moment is the United States, that they are not doing anything significant to reduce their emissions and are not talking about a carbon tax or cap and trade scheme. So what ideally you would want is say, to have somebody that's a bit like the World Trade Organization that is entitled to put trade sanctions on the United States, because they say you are externalizing one of the costs of production. The goods that you produce with energy produced in your country are imposing costs on other countries, and you therefore get an unfair trade advantage against countries like Australia or the European Union, which is the other big area that's doing something about this issue, with high levels of emissions, and you get an unfair trade advantage. And you know, what we need is a kind of global body that has the power to do that, and therefore say, so we'll, other countries can put duties on your products to overcome that balance. We're still some way from getting that, unfortunately. And because the United States is so powerful globally, and because of the way the UN is set up, it has a right of veto over that. So I'm not optimistic that we're going to get there anyway soon. But I think we do need something more like that. And I ultimately see the European Union as a model which I hope the entire world would evolve. But I'm sure that I'm not going to live to see that day when we have a global equivalent of the European Union.
Mm. Yes. Over here, with the blonde hair.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Peter. Thanks very much for your talk. I just wanted to go back to the Sri Lanka Tamil. You were talking about how we have an ethical responsibility to do something when we can do something. And I personally couldn't do something about the live export trade, but by being part of the public outcry, I feel like the government listened to that and then acted on it. I feel that being a global citizen, don't we have an ethical responsibility to, when we know that atrocities such as what happened in Sri Lanka to the Tamil community happened, that we have a responsibility, an ethical responsibility to do something about it?
Well, I mean, yeah, look, I sort of agree with that. I think that you do have more direct power over the export trade because the government is going to listen to you if you act in concert with millions of other Australians. It's going to respond to that. And by voicing your concerns, contacting the media, contacting your members of parliament or whatever, you can have a fairly direct effect. What can you do about the Sri Lankan Tamil atrocities? Well, I suppose you can also contact your government and say, please make representations to the International Criminal Court that they should launch an investigation with a view to prosecuting those responsible for these atrocities. Or you can directly contact the International Criminal Court, the UN, ask them to refer to it. There are things that you can do. So it's not that we're powerless. Maybe if I said that we're powerless, I spoke in rather too absolute terms. And it would be good to do those things. But we do feel a lot more remote from it, I think, because of that. And that's why I think it didn't provoke the same sort of outrage.
Mm. A lot of other hands going up. I'll come over here to the gentleman at the front, and then I'll come to you.
I'm most dangerous man. My name is Len LaFlamme. It's been a situation recently where the mythology that floats around in Mad Dog Radio is that it's impossible for us to move to a carbon-free situation. However, large numbers of us know that the University of Melbourne folks sat down, costed what was currently possible, and said by a certain date and time, providing you can get the equipment here, you could have zero free emissions in Australia. I think the timeline estimate was from 2015 to 2020, for a cost about the same as introducing fiber cable around the place. I think $37 billion is the comment. The question is, given the kind of contributions and alliances that the two major political parties have, are we likely to see that happen? There has been, just an aside, there's been this interesting little bit of deviation recently where our Prime Minister sat down with the Green Party and some independents and talk turkey till they got a deal. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of dangerous precedent likely to spread? Yeah. And do you see any impasse for having two parties that look like they're the same flavor?
Well, I certainly think that the Greens have played a very positive role on this issue and the independents, and I hope that continues. And as I said in my remarks, I think it was my understanding is it was the Greens who were responsible for getting this large commitment to developing clean energy. And that's, in a way, the most hopeful thing. And that's relating to the kind of thing that you're talking about. It's not actually saying, looking at that University of Melbourne plan and saying, we'll do it. But it is saying, let's do a lot more to develop this. And you know, because there were doubts raised about that costing, of course. You're talking about what are basically still relatively untried techniques for solar thermal energy, for example, generation, which Spain is working on too. And there are certainly things, a lot more that could be done there, but at the moment it's still more significantly more costly per unit of energy produced than coal. So I think we need to do more to get that cost down and to produce more of that. And I hope that the electorate will continue to put Greens in positions where they can influence the policy of whatever government is in power in Australia. I hope the independents who've done the right thing on this occasion will not be punished by their electorates for doing that. And if so, then there is some prospect that this could continue. But you know, I'm no political pundit. I'm not able to tell you how likely that is to continue.
Yes. Over here, lady here.
Hi, Peter. How are you going? Thanks for being here tonight. My question's about living in a liberal democracy and individuals' freedoms. So this was sparked from the discussion about how big the houses are now in Australia relative to everywhere else in the country. In the world. Yeah. So obviously we're here to allow our publics to have as much freedoms as they can in their personal lives, to have reproductive freedom and to have freedom to own possessions and to trade property. So what kind of a role can a government in a liberal democracy have when it's clear that having a five-bedroom house with two bathrooms is not good in the general interest of the global community, yet there's this sense of entitlement in a free market system to say, well, I've worked all my life, I want my children to have a bathroom of their own and a bath. You know, what does the government do? Can you step in and say to people, no, that's not good for the rest of the world for you to have the freedom to have that? Or do you have to say, well, no, the onus is on the individual and the family members to say, okay, well, maybe it's not in people's best interest in countries that we will never meet to do that. It seems to be like, what can a government do? Can they step in and say, no, we're going to say that from now on you can't build a house with more than four bedrooms, or do you put it back on the people to make those decisions?
I think there's something that can be done that's a little bit in between the government telling people how big a house they can have exactly and the government simply saying it's everybody's right or entitlement to build whatever size house they like. One thing that the government can do is to have building codes for sustainability. And in fact, that's what governments have done. I think it's not actually uniform federal laws, but it's coming in different states at different times. But we have recently moved to a standard of six-star housing for new homes in Australia, which is a significant improvement in terms of sustainability, in terms of how much energy they use. And you're going to see it reflected in changing designs. I mean, houses which have a lot of glass without some kind of big overhanging eave or something of that sort, you're not going to be able to build as new homes anymore, because at least at the moment we can't make them meet those six-star standards. So we're going to have differently designed homes, and nobody has an entitlement to build a home that is not reasonably energy efficient. The other side of it is we can say, if you're going to have a home, if you're going to use a lot of energy, you're going to have to pay the community for it, reflecting the costs you're imposing on others. And that's exactly what a carbon tax or a cap and trade scheme does. So I hope that eventually the level, the cost per ton of carbon, will reach a point where people, even quite wealthy people, start to think seriously about how much energy they're using. And if they do use a lot of energy, it will provide the government with more revenue, or will provide others with more revenue to invest in renewable energy alternatives, so that eventually the energy will be clean that's going into those homes.
Probably have time for another couple of questions. Yes, Jenna.
Hi, I'm wondering whether you think, as individuals, we should all be vegetarian, and do you manage it?
Okay, good question. The straight answer to that is yes, unless you have some really rare health condition that makes it difficult for you to do that. There are such people, I believe, but they're quite a small number. But otherwise, I don't think eating meat is... You know, well, I guess I could make some other exceptions. If you like to eat roadkill, for example, I have no real problem with that.
Yum!
And, you know, maybe there are some people who live sustainably on the land, rearing their own animals in their own way, making sure they're free to graze and have good lives, and then painlessly kill them on their land without transporting them to a slaughterhouse or anything like that. I suppose I could accept that. Although, as I said, if you're having cattle or sheep, it's going to be contributing to greenhouse emissions, however sustainably in other sense, however ecologically friendly it might be. Otherwise, I think, you know, it's very hard to find animal meat that has not been involved in, you know, it's been commercially raised and where animals have not suffered unnecessarily. And also, a lot of it is making significant greenhouse gas contributions. So, yes, I think you should do that. And as for me personally, I've been a vegetarian for 38 years now or something, maybe even a couple more. I'm not strictly vegan. I think ideally we would be vegan, but that's, you know, more complicated, harder to do, more of a dramatic change. So I'm mostly vegan, but somewhat flexible about that, particularly when I'm not, you know, when I'm traveling or eating out or whatever. But that's, again, that's the direction I would like to see us eventually heading.
You don't eat fish?
I don't eat fish.
Okay. Just checking. There's also a question here from Jim Dunn, which was posted online, which is related to this. And Jim says, given the symbiotic relationship of everything within nature, why is it acceptable to eat vegetables and not animals? Where do we strike the balance?
Well, I don't know if Jim's in the audience tonight, but...
Is Jim here?
I'd like to ask him what he means by the symbiotic relationship. Oh, hi.
What do you mean by the symbiotic relationship?
Can we ask you to elaborate on the symbiotic relationship between anyone? I'm thinking here about agriculturally produced tomatoes, let's say. What's their symbiotic relationship with everything and animals?
What I meant in the question was something that has troubled me, and I was not a vegan but a vegetarian for 30-odd years, and the relationship that I saw, maybe it wasn't the right word, but that the whole of our ecosystem is related to itself. So how did you ethically draw the line at the tomato as opposed to the fish, as opposed to the chicken? Where in that spectrum and what drove you to draw the line where you drove it?
Okay, so the line for me is whether the being can suffer, whether it's a conscious being capable of feeling pain or suffering. And I don't believe that tomatoes or cabbages
suffer.
I do think that fish can suffer, and I do think that chicken can suffer. And so that's why I don't eat fish or chicken. Now,
there's a gentleman in the front row who's making the case for a suffering tomato, I can tell.
You can tell because of the redness of his jacket, is that right? That tomato red? Sorry?
George argues quite well that trees, and they're plants, that trees actually sent messages when a forest was being attacked through the smells, the senses, chemical messages they went through. So I have a feeling they do have some feeling. And I remember years ago, one of my officer cadets gave a speech on vegetarianism, and I said, how do you know that plants don't feel? And that was before I met George, and he's a botanist, and he was one of the... I don't know whether that's generally accepted, but it's there to think about.
Okay, I can tell you that among scientists, it's not generally accepted. I don't know George, and I haven't seen his work, unfortunately.
We're getting into Prince Charles territory here.
But there was a dramatic claim made some years ago in a book called The Secret Life of Plants that was a bit similar. This was claimed that if you hooked up a lie detector machine, which senses nervous transmissions, to one plant, and you destroyed another or something like that, the plant responded in a certain way. And I used to get that question at that time for years, people quoting this research. But other scientists tried to replicate those results. They could never do it. So if George can get his results replicated... Okay, right, he can't... Okay, well, and of course, when you talk about messages, it's possible that some chemicals are transmitted under certain... But, that doesn't necessarily mean consciousness.
Mm. We're going to have to wrap up, I'm afraid. I just am interested to ask you, just to close this off, the question of how ethical you think Australia is now, and you've changed your categories from 2004 of the things that you assess us by when you ask that question. I just wonder how you think that could shift in another 5 years. What do you think you might be looking at in another 5 years? So how ethical are we now? What do you think you'll be looking at down the track?
Okay, so in another 5 years, I'm hoping that we will have a price on carbon that has made a difference to our emissions profile, and that we're seen as one of the nations that's doing something positive about that. I'm hoping that we've reached at least 0.5% of gross national income in foreign aid, because that's 2015-2016 financial year, I think, is the target for reaching that. That's not great, but it's better than where we are now. I'm hoping, as I said, that we are dealing with asylum seekers in a humane way, but also taking more refugees generally, because I think we can do that. I'm hoping, but probably this is rather optimistic, that we're not engaged in the live export trade anymore. So those are the sort of some of the standards that I've been talking about today, and I hope that we're in a better position. But I don't have a crystal ball. I can't say whether we will be or won't be. Just that we've made some positive steps in those directions, and I hope we keep going.
And do you think you'll be measuring other things as well down the track? Can you see things that are likely to be things you'll be looking more closely at in the future?
Yeah, possibly. Just the two things that I didn't talk about today that I dropped from the book were our involvement in the United Nations, where I thought we were quite negative under Howard because we supported the Iraq invasion, which was really contrary to United Nations principles, was not supported by the UN and contrary to the Charter as I read it, and the Howard government was really pulling back from the UN. Secondly, it was the trade issues, on which we weren't really too bad because it's in our economic interest to have open trade policies. We don't have the kind of protection for Australian agriculture that the European Union and the United States have, or subsidies for it. There may be other issues. I think opening up global trade is an important issue. I didn't talk about it today, but I hope that we have a fairer global trade regime that enables the poorest countries in the world to sell more to the rich countries and thereby help to get them out of poverty too.
Mm. I'd like to encourage all of you to go onto the website and have your say on what you think of Australia as a global citizen, and for the people watching this too, to engage in that poll. I think it'll be very interesting to see how many people do and what the results are. Peter Singer, thank you very much for your time this evening. It's been fascinating talking to you, and thank you all very much too for your questions. We covered a lot of ground. We could have kept going a lot longer, but we're out of time. So thank you very much indeed. Thank you, Peter Singer.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.